Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it gives me great pleasure to join you on this program again. This is a series in which we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse. It's been quite a while. It's the 141st episode. So the journey has been long and we still are somewhere just around the midway of the Bhagavad Gita. We are in the 10th chapter. We've crossed the halfway mark of the 10th chapter. The chapter itself is about Krishna is listing out the various places and individuals in which he can be found. The chapter's name is the Vibhuti Yoga, which means in what aspects of life, in what aspects of the Puranas, in the scriptures, in your own experience in daily life, can you find reflections of the divine glory? That's the whole essence of the 10th chapter. This particular portion that we are going through, there are many references to Puranic characters as well as philosophical concepts. Either way, the point is anything that is glorious, that stands out in a good way, you can look upon that as an aspect of divinity, as divine glory being reflected in that individual entity. That's what we've been going through. We covered two verses last time, verses 23 and 24 of the 10th chapter, but we started by completing the 22nd verse, a few phrases that we had left out. So we will also start our summary from that. In the 22nd shloka, we saw Krishna stating, Indriyanam mana asmi. I am the mind among the senses. The sense organs of the visual organs, the organs of sense, of touch, the organs of listening, these are all merely like windows to the inner akasha, as Swami would say. The antakarana is often referred to as the inner sky, you know. So the senses are like windows to this internal system that we have. They do not do anything. They do not judge anything. So the mind is like a person who is probably standing beside this window, and either he or she is admiring the scene or feels a stench that is coming along, and then there's a contortion in the face. The windows themselves do not make the judgment, but the person who looks through these windows or who looks at these inputs or receives these inputs through these windows is the one who makes the judgment, and that is the mind, right? So that is why Krishna says, among the sense organs, Indriyanam, I am the mind. And also mind is the one that is responsible for the good or the wrong use of the senses. The other important point that Krishna makes in the 22nd verse is, Bhutanam asmi chetana, among the living beings, I am consciousness. We discussed the various layers of meaning in the statement. This is very similar to a statement from the Kinopanishad that says that I am the sentience in the sentient. So the word chetana is that sentience that expresses itself in various beings. In animals, it expresses in a limited form, in plants, in an even more limited form. But when it comes to the human form, it expresses itself as buddhi, as intellect, as talent, as the various actions that one performs. And contemplating on it, Swami says that you will realize that this chetana in you is nothing but a reflection of that supreme chetana or super consciousness. I'd read out a portion from Swami's Upanishad Vahini, a commentary on the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where sage Yajnavalkya explains the same concept. So in contemplation of this one statement, you realize that whatever you do, whatever you think are your actions, your thoughts, your choices are nothing but a reflection of that super consciousness. And the whole idea of the Vibhuti Yoga is that when you contemplate deeply on some of these statements that Krishna is stating, they will reveal to you subtle aspects and esoteric understandings that you are capable of understanding. In the 23rd verse, Krishna goes back to references from the Puranas. He says, among the Rudras, again another set of celestial beings, he says, I am Shankara or Lord Shiva. I am Kubera among Yakshas and Rakshasas, again another set of celestial beings which are not elevated to the state of Devas in the Puranas, but they are higher than the human beings. So he says, I am Kubera among Yakshas and Rakshasas. Again, I recalled a small story from the Mahabharata itself, which shows what makes Kubera stand apart from the Yakshas, what makes him the king of the Yakshas. Then Krishna says, among Vasus, I am fire. Vasus, the eight Vasus, are again considered to be deities that rule certain elemental aspects of creation. Then going to the 24th verse, Krishna says, among Purodhasas or priests, I am Brihaspati, the celestial priest of the heavens. And we also discuss what it means. This Purodhasa means the priest is someone who facilitates the ability to have benefits in the future. You know, whatever yajnas you perform, whatever rituals you perform are to receive something in the future, and the priest is one who helps you achieve that, and that is the meaning of the word Purodhasa. And among Purodhasas, he says, I am Brihaspati, again an exalted person in the stories that you find in the Puranas, Manasaputra of Brahma. And again, we went into a small discussion about what is the essence of Krishna saying that I am this person and I am that person. He goes on to say again in that 24th verse, among the army chiefs, I am Skanda or Lord Subramanya, who is considered the chief of the Deva armies. He is called Deva Senapati, right? So the idea of Krishna saying that I am these exalted individuals is when you look at someone in a position that is enviable, quote unquote enviable, how to deal with that envy or how not to be envious or jealous of that person. One of the beautiful ways that Krishna is giving is to look upon that talent, that authority, that achievement as nothing but a vibhuti of the Lord. Then the final statement that Krishna makes in that shloka is that sarasam asmi sagaraha, among stagnant water bodies, I am the ocean. Sarasa is any stagnant body. It could even be a puddle or a pool or something as large as a lake. Even ocean is considered one of the sarasas or stagnant water bodies. But the ocean is a limitless body of water that can never be diminished or drained by any amount of drawing water from it, right? That's the concept of the ocean. So Krishna says, among bodies that are stagnant, I am that body of water which is not dependent on anything or which cannot be diminished by anything. So he says, sarasam asmi sagaraha. So that is the 24th verse that we had come across. We'll go to the 25th verse. We'll see if we can be a little faster, because many of what Krishna is saying here are all Puranic stories, and I would rather leave it to each one of you to go up and look up these names. But I will here and there try to tell a few stories, because that's the only way to explain some of these shlokas. So we'll listen to shloka number 25. As always, we'll listen to it in the beautiful rendition of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a brief meaning after that, and then we will discuss what Krishna is conveying in these shlokas.
महर्षीणां भृगुरहं गिरामस्म्येकमक्षरं यज्ञानां जपयज्ञोऽस्मि स्थावराणां हिमालयः.
Of the great seers, I am Bhrigu. Of words, I am the single-lettered word Om. Of sacrifices, I am the sacrifice of Japa. Of immovable things, I am the Himalayas. So that is the 25th verse of the 10th chapter. This again is another important shloka. There is one statement which is very important. We'll come to that. And of course, one of the statements is a repetition of an idea that Krishna has already spoken about. The first thing he says is, Maharishinam, among the great rishis, Bhrigurahaṁ, I am Bhrigu. Bhrigu is, again, one of the Manasaputras, the sons born from the mind of Brahma. He's considered to be one of the greatest sages, just like how he said, among the priests, I am Brihaspati. Here he says, among the Maharishis. Maharishis themselves are great beings, individuals who have risen who raised themselves to the state of great perfected beings. So among them, he says, I am Bhrigu. Then Krishna says, Giram, among the words, Asmi Ekam Aksharam, I am the one-syllabled word. Which is that one-syllabled word? Ekam Aksharam is again a phrase or a term that has been used before. That's why I said one of the statements is a repetition. The one-syllabled word that Krishna is referring to is Om. What was referred to earlier as Ekaksharam Brahma. The one-syllabled word that stands for the Supreme Being. When Krishna says Giram, it means among all speech, among all spoken word, which means this is a reference to all languages. This is not merely to the language of Sanskritam or the languages that have come from it. It refers to all spoken word and all spoken language. We'd spoken extensively about the Pranava Mantra when Krishna had made a very similar statement in the 7th chapter where he said, I am the Pranava in the Vedas. At that time, I had mentioned how Pranava is also referred to as the Anahata Dhvani, the unstruck sound. In case any of you have missed that episode and would like to revisit that episode, you can feel free to write to me. I'll point out the exact episode to you because I don't remember exactly the number of that episode. I think there were two episodes. We extensively spoke about the Pranava Mantra in those two. Om is the verbal representation of the concept of Pranava. As all of us know, it consists of three sounds, A, U, and M, or Ma. If you observe, A, or the first sound of that Pranava Mantra, represents the sound that emanates when you simply part your lips. When you just open your mouth, the first sound that comes without any modification of the sound that comes from your mouth is the sound A. You make any sound from the throat and simply part the lips, the sound that comes out is A. Similarly, the sound Ma or M is the sound that comes when you simply close your mouth. And the sound U represents all the sounds that can be created by the contortions of the mouth. O, A, A, U, and all of that comes from this, is represented by this middle syllable or middle sound, U. So in that sense, A, U, and M represent all sounds, and even a person without a tongue who is not able to speak, or even animals, all their languages can be represented by this Ekaksharam Om. Krishna had said, this is the best sound or word that can be used to represent God. We had discussed this. Pada means word, Padartha means that object which can be represented by this Pada. So if Om is the Pada, the Padartha for whom is Brahman. So Om is the name that represents God, and it is one name that includes all names that you could say. Because when you say Om represents all spoken word, and when you also say Om is a name of God, you could say that if you want to take one word, one name which will represent all names of God, then it is Om. Ek Aksharam Brahma. This is a beautiful story which probably you might have heard, a simple anecdote. they say that there was a little child who would sit in front of the altar and religiously every day recite the alphabets A, B, C, D 3 or 4 times, right? And the idea was, after reciting these alphabets, the child would say to God, "God, I don't know how to pray, but my teacher tells me that all the words in every book in the world is made only out of these 26 alphabets. So I'm reciting these alphabets. You make the best prayer out of them and accept it as my prayer to you." So chanting Om is a prayer like that. It is equivalent to calling all the names of God. Since God cannot be represented by any one name in any one language, Om, that represents all sounds of spoken language, is probably the best symbol of this symbol of divinity. Then Krishna says a very important statement: Yajnanam, among the various sacrifices, Japa Yajnaha, I am the Japa or silent contemplation of the name of God. A very important statement. What is the purpose of any yajna? What is the purpose of any form of worship? Yajna is nothing but a form of worship, a form of prayer, right? And the purpose of any yajna, any form of worship, is nothing but antakarana shuddhi. So when Krishna says yajnanam, among the various sacrifices, japa yajnaha, what does that really represent? To let go of that which is bad and take in that which is good is the process by which you purify anything, right? When you want to purify a reservoir of water, generally we say that you have an overhead tank with water. One of the ways in which you can purify it is let in copious amounts of good water. Eventually, all the bad will be flushed out and what you'll be left with is good. There is no yajna that is better to achieve this with regards to the mind than japa. Every other ritual or worship is only adding paraphernalia to, in the form of actions, to this concept of japa, isn't it? So that's why Krishna says, among the various kinds of forms of worship that you can think of, I am japa yajna. And yajnas, as described in the Puranas and other scriptures, can be extremely elaborate, right? When Yudhishthira wants to do Ashwamedha yajna at the end of the Kurukshetra battle, he says that I probably have committed so much sin in the form of this battle, so I need to atone for this. And he says, I want to do an Ashwamedha yajna, and not one, I want to do 2 Ashwamedha yajnas. In fact, Swami writes about this in the Bhagavata Vahini. It's a very beautiful portion. We had discussed it as part of our Bhagavata Vahini Satsang too. You can go and read up that portion. A very beautiful dialogue between Lord Krishna and the Pandavas, especially Yudhishthira, happens in this portion. So Yudhishthira wants to do 2 Ashwamedha yajnas to atone for the sins that he might have committed as part of that battle. But to perform an Ashwamedha yajna is not simple. Put aside all the other complications, merely because how expensive it is. And here is a king who has just come out of a battle, which has taken a huge economic toll on the kingdom. So to perform an Ashwamedha yajna is not going to be so simple. So Krishna guides them to a place where there is enough gold, which he says that many decades ago, there was a grand yajna which was performed, and the king, whoever performed that yajna, as part of the gifts that he was giving away to the Brahmins, gave enormous amounts of gold and silver that these people were not able to carry it back. So they had to leave it on the way. So Krishna tells, I know exactly where all this gold is. So you can go there and retrieve that gold and do the Ashwamedha yajna with that. So even for kings and chakravartis or emperors, these yajnas were quite elaborate and quite expensive. But Krishna did not say, among the yajnas, I am the Rajasuya or I am the Ashwamedha. They are the grand yajnas. But he chose to say, I am Japa Yajna. I am that yajna or that worship that even the poorest of the poor can do. Even the simplest of the devotee who wishes to perform a worship can do. All that you need for Japa Yagna is you yourself. You just have to sit in a place and recall the name of your liking. That is all is Japa, isn't it? So that Japa that does not require any wealth, material or expertise, Krishna says, I am that Yagna. And again, given the emphasis that Krishna is laying on devotion in this entire section, as we said, starting from the 9th chapter, Krishna has started speaking or hinting at the importance of bhakti. And when you say bhakti is important, there is no surprise that Krishna is saying that among the various yajnas, japa is that which is most significant. And then in the same shloka, Krishna says, Sthavaranam, among the immovable things, Himalayaha, I am the Himalayas. That's again a very interesting statement. If you recall, Krishna has already made a mention of Meru, where he said, among all peaks, I am Meru. But here he is saying, Sthavaranam, among the immovable things, I am Himalayas. And Sthavara is also another name for mountains, right? In the Puranas, there is a very interesting story which says that in the earlier yugas, the mountains were not immobile, or at least not all mountains were immobile. There were the concept of flying mountains. There were some mountains which had wings, right? And you can understand that they did cause a lot of concern for the people living in the ground. And the story goes that Indra with his Vajrayuda went around cutting the wings of these mountains, making them immovable. And one of the mountains which escaped this treatment by Lord Indra was a mountain called Mainaka. Mainaka was a friend of Vayudeva, the lord of the wind, and using the influence of Vayudeva, Mainaka was hidden under the ocean. Under Sagara's protection, Mainaka was saved from the wrath of Indra. And that is how you have this famous story in the Ramayana, where when Hanuman is trying to cross over the ocean and reach Lanka, it is the Mainaka peak which raises up and says that, oh, here is Hanuman, the son of Vayu, my dear friend who has helped me. And he is going as part of an errand to help Lord Rama. Lord Rama is considered to be one of the descendants of Sagara, right? So Mainaka chooses that as an opportune moment to express its gratitude to Vayudeva and Sagara. So that is how the story where the Mainaka peak raises up from under the ocean and requests Hanuman to take a break before he proceeds further. And that is spoken of as one of the sattvic obstacles that comes through in one's path. It's a topic for a different day. It's a long topic, so we will not go into that, but I'm just making a reference to that. So what Krishna says here is, Sthavaranam, among the immovable peaks or immovable mountains, I am Himalayas. If you were to look at all the peaks, then I am Meru. So that is what Krishna says in the 25th verse of this chapter. We'll go to the next shloka, the 26th shloka. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we will discuss in detail.
Ashvathas sarva vrikshanam devarshinam cha naradah gandharvanam chitraratah siddhanam kapilo munihi.
Among all trees, I am Ashvata, and Narada among the divine sages. Among the Gandharvas, I am Chitraratha, among the perfected ones, the sage Kapila. So that is the 26th verse of the 10th chapter. Krishna continues a similar set of vibhutis. In each case, the reason that entity is being pointed out can be different, as we've seen before. We're going to continue to see that. And truly speaking, there is no one point or reason, right? That's what we can observe. In this shloka, he first says, Sarva Vrikshanam, among all trees, Ashwattha, I am the Ashwattha tree. Ashwattha, which is scientifically called the Ficus religiosa, it's considered a very sacred tree in Indian tradition. I mean, those of you who are from India know this, Ashwattha tree is considered very worthy of worship even. More commonly called the people tree, it is considered very sacred. The Bodhi tree under which Buddha attained his enlightenment is also an Ashwattha tree. And that's why the Ashwattha tree is very sacred even for the followers of Buddhism and Jainism. The yajnas that are performed often use the twigs of the Ashwattha tree. According to some scriptures, the roots, the trunk and the branches of the Ashwattha tree represent Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara. Ashwattha, in fact, is called the tree of life, and there is a very powerful imagery related to the Ashwattha tree. But maybe we'll reserve it for later, because Krishna is going to speak about the Ashwattha tree and that particular imagery a little later, I think in one of the chapters that are going to come, 15 chapter or so. So we will take up Ashwattha tree in a little more detail when we do that. But the Ashwattha tree, as you know, is a very sacred tree. If you come into the Prashanthi Nilayam Ashram, the first tree that greets you is the Ashwattha tree, under which you have the Naga statues. It has a beautiful story related to that, but I will not go into that. Probably we'll do a nice Prashanthi Chronicles episode on that Ashwattha tree and the Naga statues there. I'll leave it to Brother Bishu, who is our Prashanthi Chronicles expert. We will request him to do an episode on that, and maybe that day, through that program, we will present to you some facts and beautiful and interesting stories about Swami and that tree. Going ahead in the shloka, Krishna says, Deva Rishinam, and among the divine rishis, Deva Rishinam Naradaha, I am Narada. I'm sure no one needs an introduction to sage Narada. I'm sure all of us will know who Narada is, one of the most interesting and enchanting and attractive characters in the Puranas. A very jolly-go-lucky and lovable character, a very mischievous one, very close to what we speak of as the mischievousness of Lord Krishna or Lord Vishnu, a party to many a mischiefs played by these divine beings too. Krishna had already said that I am sage Bhrigu among the rishis. But here he is speaking of another category of rishis called Deva rishis. He says, Deva rishinam Narada. A rishi is a mortal being who has raised himself or herself to that state where they are mantra drashtaras, right? They're able to become conduits of some divine secrets. That's how the Vedas have come to us. It is believed that they were able to visualize some of these mantras, and they were codified and then passed on generation to generation. But what we are talking of as Devarishis are divine beings who reside in celestial realms, and given how Krishna is trying to emphasize the importance of bhakti as a path, he says, I am Narada among the Devarishis. Most rishis are known for their penance, their wisdom, their austerities, but Narada's name is always synonymous with the bhakti tradition, right? Narada Bhakti Sutra, we say, is one of the gifts, the scriptures gifted by Narada to humanity, and that is all about bhakti. And whenever you talk about Narada, you think of the tradition of Namasmarana. He's always pictured as one who carries around a tampura and who's always reciting and singing the name of the Lord, right? In fact, he is supposed to be the source of the Sankirtana tradition itself, which Swami says is the most effective tool in this age of Kali. So in this shloka, Krishna is going to name another such person as Vibhuti, but we'll come to that. But in this portion, he says, among the various Devarishis, I am Narada. Probably another way by which Krishna is emphasizing the importance of japa, importance of nama sankirtana, importance of music, importance of bhakti. Then Krishna says, Gandharvanam, among the Gandharvas, I am Chitraratha. Again, a character we may not be familiar with, but Arjuna knows him quite well because even in the Mahabharata, there is an interaction between Arjuna and this Gandharva by name Chitraratha. For those of you who may not know, Gandharvas are again another set of celestial beings, just like the Yakshas. Gandharvas are specifically known for their talent in music and dance, and Chitraratha is one of the best and most talented among the Gandharvas. So I think it suffices for us to know that Chitraratha is a very fine Gandharva, and Krishna is saying that, you know, Chitraratha, O Arjuna, is a very fine Gandharva. Know that he is also one of my Vibhutis. And the last point that Krishna makes is Siddhanam. Among the Siddhas, or the perfected beings, Kapilaha Munihi. I am sage Kapila. Siddhas, the word Siddhi itself means to attain something. And Siddhas are those who have attained a certain state or who have attained a certain state of perfection. Those are Siddhas, perfected beings. And according to Adi Shankara, Siddhas are those individuals who are born with a wealth of wisdom, right? They have not, like the rishis who have elevated themselves to a certain state. Siddhas are believed to be those who are born with a certain amount of the wealth of wisdom. And Kapila is a sage pretty much like Bhrigu and Narada, but he falls in the category of Siddhas. And sage Kapila is known to have given the entire Sankhya philosophy that we made references to heavily when we were going through the concept of creation, the ideas of the Tanmatras, the Gunas playing a very important role in creation. All of that comes from Sankhya philosophy. And Sankhya philosophy is believed to be given by Kapila Muni. And Kapila Muni, in fact, is considered as one of the avatars of Lord Vishnu. He has been born to Mother Devahuti as a blessing. Lord Vishnu says, I will be born to you as Kapila Muni. In the Bhagavata Purana, there's a very important episode where Kapila Muni gives a discourse to his mother Devahuti. This conversation is supposed to be very deeply philosophical, but at the same time, what makes this conversation or discussion important is that in this, he gives his mother the reason why worshipping God as a person, personifying God as an entity with likes and dislikes, oh, I can make him happy this way, or I can praise him this way, I can please him this way. That concept, which is fundamental or very essential in any form of worship or any form of bhakti, apparently Kapila Muni in that discussion or in that discourse to his mother Devahuti explains this, and that is considered a very important text that forms the basis for the bhakti tradition. So among all the Siddhas, when Krishna says, I am Kapila, in whose form Krishna himself taught the importance of personifying God as a loving being and worshipping him. Krishna is mentioning that here. Again, something that points out to the importance of bhakti. As I said, you can see how Krishna very subtly in all of this is hinting towards having a very worshipful attitude, and how that is a very important thing when you want to take up to the path of karma yoga. So these are the things that Krishna says in the 26th verse. We'll go to the next verse, the 27th verse. We'll see what are the vibhutis that Krishna mentions in this verse.
Uchai shravasamashvanam vidhimamamrutodhavam ಐರಾವತಂಗಜೇಂದ್ರಾಣಾಂ ನರಾಣಾಂಚ ನರಾಧಿಪಂ.
Of the horses, know me to be Uchchai Shravas, the nectar-born. Of lordly elephants, I am the Airavata, and of men, I am the monarch. So that's the 27th verse. I think most of us would be aware of the episode of the Sagara Manthana or Samudra Manthana from the Puranas, one of the most popular episodes. The avatar of Kurma is associated with that. There is the avatar of Mohini, which is not mentioned in the Dashavatars, but again, an important avatar of Lord Vishnu that is associated with this. It's a very popular Puranic story where the Asuras and Devas come together. They churn the Kshira Sagara, the ocean of milk, in an attempt to bring forth from within the Amritam or the elixir of immortality. Many of the individuals and entities involved in that episode are mentioned by Krishna in this portion of this chapter, this shloka, and the next one too. You will find a lot of mention of the entities involved in that. So the first one he says is, Uchchai Shravasam Ashvanam Vidhimam. Know me among horses to be Uchchai Shravas. So when the Kshirasagara or the ocean of milk was churned, many exotic things are said to have come from it before the Amritam or the elixir itself comes out. And one of them is this horse by name Uchchai Shravas. Supposed to be a winged horse with 7 heads, and that's why Krishna says, Uchchai Shravasam Ashvanam Vidhimam Amrutotbhavam. That which is born of Amrita. The Kshira Sagara is also called Amrita because it holds Amrita in it. So Amrutotbhavam means that horse which is born out of the Kshira Sagara by name Uchchai Shravas. Know me to be that among the horses. So clearly an exotic horse, not any ordinary horse. So Krishna says, know that to be one of my vibhutis. Then Krishna says, Airavatam Gajendranam. Among the royal elephants, Gaja means elephant, Gajendra means royal elephants or lordly elephants, as it is translated in some places. So among the royal elephants, know me to be Airavata. The white elephant that is described as having 10 tusks and 5 trunks, born to Iravati. This is another, the Airavat is again another product of that churning process. This eventually becomes the Vahana of the vehicle of Indra. Then Krishna makes a very general statement. He says, Cha and Naranam, among men, Naradhipam, the king. Who is a king among men? In today's modern society, we don't have kings, or even if we do have kings in certain countries, they have more of a mere titular post, right, with no authority and no relevance in that in the governance of that country in that sense. So when Krishna says king, among men I am king, we could say that he is referring to authority in general, or having the ability to influence the life of others, right? Or those who are looked upon by the society. In the past, a king or a queen had authority not merely because they belonged to a certain family or they were born to a king. The people looked upon them as being representatives of God. The king would be called Narendra, right? Narendra means the lord of men. You know, he's supposed to be a representative of God. And that is the tradition of monarchy. They worship the king not because the king is worship worthy. They worship the king because he is a representation of God. And that's why Krishna says that any such authority, admiration, respect that is given to a person, if we attain that state where we are having influence over a large body of people, or we are having authority, or people are looking up to us for guidance, that authority, that admiration is nothing but a vibhuti of the Lord. Just like how a lake sparkles when the moon is reflected on it, this authority of humans is nothing but a reflection of that supreme authority that Bhagwan holds, right? That's a very important point. Last week we spoke about jealousy being sublimated by the contemplation of some of these vibhutis. Similarly, even the idea of hubris or pride or ego can be sublimated by contemplating on the vibhutis of the Lord. If at all we ever are in that position, be it as a minister or be it as a leader of a group, let us look upon that status that we are enjoying or we are having at that point as nothing more than a reflection of the Lord's glory, and it has got nothing to do with us, right? That's a contemplation that's very important in the spiritual path. So that was the 27th verse. We'll go to the next verse. We'll see what Krishna is saying there and what are the vibhutis that Krishna is mentioning in that one.
Ayudhanamaham vajram dhenunamasmi kamadhuk prajanaschasmi kandarpah sarpanamasmi vasukihi.
Of weapons I am Vajra, the thunderbolt. Of cows I am Kamadhuk. Among the causes of progeny I am Kandarpa. Of serpents I am Vasuki. So that is the 28th verse of the 10th chapter. Krishna continues with further references from the Puranas. It would be impossible to tell all the stories related to whatever Krishna is mentioning here. I will tell a few here and there, as I've been telling already. The simple point is, as we have seen all through, anything extraordinary, superlative by nature, is what it is because of God and nothing more, right? That is the idea that is being conveyed in all that is said. Again, in this verse also, Krishna makes a few references to the Sagara Mantana episode in the Puranas. He says, the first thing he says, of course, is different. It's not related to the Sagara Mantana. He says, Ayudhanam, among the weapons, Aham Vajram. I am the Vajra. Vajra or Vajrayudham is the weapon that is used by Lord Indra, the master of the Devas. It is sometimes spoken of as being the thunderbolt, because Lord Indra is also supposed to be the Lord of the rains and the clouds. So his ayuda or his weapon is spoken of as being the thunderbolt. The legend behind the Vajrayuda is that there was one asura by name Vritra. He had captured the heavens and he had dethroned Indra and all the devas. This asura Vritra had a boon that he could not be killed with any weapon that was in use till that point in time. And no weapons made of wood or metal or any such elements which are already in use can harm him in any way. So when he dethroned the devas and he occupied the heavens, there was no way in which the devas could fight with him using the weapons that were already there and win a battle with him. So as always, the devas approach Lord Vishnu asking for his help. Then Lord Vishnu says, only a weapon made of the bones of a sage by name Dadichi can kill the asuras. Now, sage Dadichi was a great sage whose bones, they say, had become as hard as diamonds. The word for diamonds in Sanskrit is Vajra, right? So his bones had become so hard as diamond, either on account of his penance or some Puranas say that he had received a boon from Lord Shiva that his bones would become so hard and he cannot be harmed by any human beings. But Lord Indra and Dadichi had a difficult past, right? They had old enmity. Indra had once beheaded the sage who was later revived by the Ashwini Kumaras, the Ashwini twins, who had learnt the Madhu Vidya from the sage. Madhu Vidya is supposed to be a technique by which you can resurrect people after their death. And the sage already had this knowledge, which made Indra uncomfortable. And he had, you know, put a ban on the sage passing on this knowledge to anybody else. But the sage passed on the knowledge to the Ashwini Kumaras. And the Ashwini Kumaras knew that Indra had told that if at all anybody passes this knowledge, that person will be beheaded. So they knew that Indra is going to come and behead Dadichi. So the story goes, they themselves behead Dadichi. They put a head of a horse instead of the sage's head. And then when Indra comes, he finds the sage with the head of a horse. So he beheads the horse head. The Ashwini Kumaras by then have learnt this Madhu Vidya, so they replace Dadichi's original head and revive him from the dead. So there is this difficult past between Dadichi and Indra. But what this Asura Vritra had done was, after conquering the heavens, he had started creating a drought which was causing immense trouble to the people of the world. So when Indra approaches the sage with a lot of hesitancy because of this past that he has had with him, the sage readily agrees to sacrifice his life so that a weapon can be created from his bones. He says, because what is at stake is the welfare of the world, and I cannot hold my enmity against Indra as a reason for blocking something that is going to benefit the world, right? But then the story goes that even though he is ready to put aside his animosity instantly and be of use, he says that I had only one desire, that I wanted to visit all these sacred rivers of the Bharatavarsha and have a dip in them. And I only hope that I'll have enough time to finish that desire that I had, and I can come and offer myself to you. So at that point, Indra says that, oh, we don't have so much time. So what I will do is I will bring all these sacred rivers to this very place and you can fulfill your wish. And that is how Indra brings all the sacred rivers to that point, which happens to be the Kshetra of Naimisharanya. Even today, Naimisharanya is considered to be a very, very holy Kshetra, because taking a dip in the river at Naimisharanya is equal to taking a dip in all the sacred rivers in the entire Bharatvarsha, right? So Naimisharanya becomes very sacred because of this episode. Sage Dadichi takes his desired dip over there, and then through a process of yoga, he offers him his life up. And his bones, especially his spine, is used to create what is referred to as the Vajrayuda, supposed to be one of the most powerful weapons. But from the story, you can see it is not a mere weapon like any other. It is a weapon which is a symbol of penance and sacrifice, right? And that's why probably Krishna says, among all the weapons, I represent the Vajrayuda, not because it is the most powerful. It is because it is a weapon that represents self-sacrifice. It's a weapon that represents penance. And it is a weapon that represents the larger good, right? Maybe that is why Krishna says, among all the weapons, I am represented by the Vajrayuda. Then Krishna says, Dhenu naam asmi kamadhuk. Among the cows, I am kamadhuk, which is another name for kamadhenu. Again, a legendary cow and also a product of the churning of the ocean. Kamadhenu is considered a wish-fulfilling cow. The name itself means a cow that gives or fulfills all your desires. Kamadhenu. It gives you all that you desire. All cows are considered givers, right? More so because of the milk and the curd, and most importantly, the ghee that is received from the cow. Because when you look at ghee, becomes a very important component in the performance of yajnas, and all yajnas are performed with the desire to fulfill some wish or some aspiration or desire. So a cow itself is considered to be that entity which helps us achieve our desires, because it forms an important part of this process of yajna. Among such cows, Kamadhenu is a cow that can give you anything directly. It is not that it is going to give you a milk, and that milk can be made into curd and butter, and from there you get the ghee, and from the ghee you perform the yajnas and fulfill your desires. Kamadhenu is a cow that represents the ability of the cow to grant you directly what you seek, right? Another famous legend about Kamadhenu is the rivalry between sage Vasishtha and sage Vishwamitra. At the point when this rivalry happens, Kamadhenu is in the possession of sage Vasishtha, and Vishwamitra was still a king. He had not become a sage. He was king. He was a king by name Kaushika. As king, when he visits sage Vasishtha's ashram, with the help of Kamadhenu, sage Vasishtha feeds not only the king but his entire army with a grand feast. And Kaushika is really surprised how the sage Vasishtha has pulled this kind of a grand reception for him and his army. And then he finds out about this divine cow which is in the possession of sage Vasishtha, and then Kaushika tells him that such a cow should be in the possession of the king, and that will benefit the entire kingdom. But then sage Vasishtha very politely refuses. He says that Kamadhenu can only be in the possession of a Brahmin, and it can never be possessed by a Kshatriya. The idea behind it is, as long as you have not sublimated the rajasic nature, you cannot possess Kamadhenu, or you are not entitled to possess Kamadhenu. King Kaushika is extremely hurt and belittled by this comment of sage Vasishtha, so he decides to take the cow by force, and he sets his army on the cow. But Kamadhenu then creates a huge army that eventually defeats the army of Kaushika. And Kaushika feels very, very hurt and insulted by this, because he says, what is the point of me being such a great king, such a great emperor, if I cannot possess a single cow, right? That's the sense that he is left with at the end of this encounter. And it is said that it is after this he chooses to give up his entire wealth and authority, and he becomes a renunciant, and he says, I will make myself worthy of possessing Kamadhenu. And that is how this journey of King Kaushika becoming this great sage Vishwamitra, who eventually gives the Gayatri Mantra to the world, begins. So Krishna is saying, I am Kamadhenu. For all of us, Swami is that Kamadhenu, isn't it? The fulfiller of all our wishes. But in that wish-fulfilling trait is hidden this agenda of his to make us all vairagis like Vishwamitra, right? Maybe that is why Krishna is saying, among all wish-fulfilling, all cows are considered to be wish-fulfilling. Among all wish-fulfilling cows, I am Kamadhenu, which first of all gives you directly what you desire for. But hidden in that trait is this agenda of pushing you towards sublimating all the rajas and tamas and becoming sattvic and becoming a vairagi, right? Then Krishna says, Prajanaha, among causes for creation, Asmi Kandarpaha. I am Kandarpa, which is another name for Kamadeva or Cupid. Prajanaha means progenitors, or those who are involved in bringing forth life into earth. It's a beautiful statement that Krishna is making here, a very, very significant one. Krishna says, I am the love that is the basis of all procreation. Prajanaha, among the all causes of procreation, among all kinds of people who are involved in bringing life into this earth, I am Kamadeva. Krishna is reminding us through this statement how sacred this act of procreation is. We often talk of passion or carnal desires as being lower instincts, right? But even that, Krishna says, is to be contemplated as a vibhuti of the Lord. And when you see it that way, the approach towards it will be one of responsibility and not merely indulgence or pleasure seeking, right? That's a very important point that Krishna is making there, that I am the love that is hidden behind this act of procreation, and you are supposed to contemplate upon it as being a vibhuti of the Lord. The final statement that he makes in that shloka is, Sarpanam asmi vasukihi. Among the serpents, I am Vasuki. Another reference to the Sagara Mantana. Vasuki is supposed to be the king of serpents. Some Puranas say that it is Vasuki who is the snake who adorns the neck of Lord Shiva. So, indeed, one of the finest of snakes, I'm sure. When we say snake, the first thing that comes to mind is poison, right? Snakes are poisonous beings. That's the first thing that always comes to our mind. So Vasuki is said to be so poisonous, forget about the fangs, its very breath can kill, is what is the description given about Vasuki. When this Sagara Mantana episode was meant to happen, you know, it's a churning process. You have a churning rod, the Mandara mountain, as I said, becomes the churning rod, and they needed something that would act as a rope. So they go to Lord Vishnu again and they ask, what about the rope? What do we use as a rope to churn this mountain? And that is when Lord Vishnu says, you go and ask Vasuki. So this is going to be a really painful process, to be tied around this rod and then to be pulled by the asuras and the devas on either side. But again, Vasuki readily agrees, knowing well it is going to be a very painful process. Again, an example of self-sacrifice for larger good. Again, the story goes that the devas are very much aware that Vasuki is a very poisonous snake. So when they decide that Vasuki is going to be used as the rope, they go and catch the head of the snake, pretending as though that is the more significant part of the snake, and we will take it because we are the devas. The moment the devas do this, the asuras think, this is like belittling us, that you are giving the lower part of the body of the snake to us. No, we are equal to you or even better than you, so we will go and take the head of the snake. So that is how the asuras come and hold the head of the snake, and this reverse psychology has worked in the favor of the devas. So when they start churning the ocean, some Puranas say the hala hala poison comes from the mouth of Vasuki. Some Puranas say that it was a product of the churning itself. It came from the Kshirasagara. But nevertheless, the hala hala is produced, and it is to protect the world from hala hala. You have the episode where Lord Shiva comes and drinks the hala hala. Mother Parvati ensures that it does not go further down from the throat, and Lord Shiva becomes Neelakantha. So many, many Puranic stories, but the essence of what Krishna is saying, you can see the drift is pretty much the same. So we'll conclude with that. Dear listeners, thank you for being with me. I'll meet you all again as part of the Gita series next week at 10 a.m. with the next episode. We'll resume our pilgrimage of the Gita series then. I will join you again at 12 for an afternoon satsang today. As I was saying last week, I am doing a live afternoon satsang. It's going to be a little different than the usual afternoon satsangs. So if you are available, do tune in at 12 for the afternoon satsang. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next episode of Outside Inside Deep Inside. Till I meet you next time, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.